This course really started something over 30 years ago when I got involved in an argument between two University of Chicago economists and two University of Chicago legal scholars over the question really of whether it made sense to have a legal system in which, in effect, criminal law was replaced by civil law. That is, the idea suggested was instead of having a policeman be a paid salaried employee, say that when the policeman convicts somebody and he pays a $10,000 fine, that fine goes to the policeman, and you then have essentially freelance. And that is, as the law professors pointed out, the way our tort system currently works. If you're the victim of a, if somebody dents your car, you don't call the cop ultimately, you call a lawyer, you sue, and his payment goes to you. And I got interested in that because I thought I had read about a legal system that actually worked that way about 1,000 years ago in Iceland. And that was a legal system where there was a legislature, there was a court system, and there was no executive arm of government. So after you got your verdict, it was up to you to enforce it. So it was a more extreme version than had been suggested in this discussion. And I got interested enough, so I read everything I could find on it and wrote an article. And eventually, the people at Chicago invited me to come to Chicago Law School to argue with them at closer range. And I spent about 10 years as a faculty fellow there. And in the course of that, I got interested in another legal system, which was 18th century English criminal law. 18th century English criminal law, on paper, is our legal system. That's where we got it from. The only thing is there were no police or public prosecutors. So that was a legal system in which any Englishman could prosecute any crime. And in practice, it was the victim or an agent of the victim who prosecuted a crime. And that raised a whole bunch of interesting puzzles that we'll be talking about later in the course, because unlike a tort system, once you win your case, they hang the guy so you don't get any damage payment. Or they don't hang him. That's one of the interesting puzzles, is that that was a legal system where on paper all serious offenses were capital. But in fact, if you were charged with a capital offense, you had maybe one chance in 8 of getting hanged. So if you were convicted, maybe a 40% chance. So that's another one we can talk about. But I was just going to say that the way I got into this was that a good many years after that, when I was teaching at this university, it occurred to me that I'd learned lots of interesting stuff studying these two legal systems. It had been a lot of fun, and I'd been very lazy and hadn't done it since. And I needed what economists call a commitment strategy, a way of tying my hands to make myself do something I wanted to do. So I announced that the next year I was teaching a seminar on legal systems very different from ours. And that's what this ultimately comes out of, because having announced that, obviously, I had to learn about a bunch of legal systems. And I taught that every other year for quite a long time here. The basic idea of the course is that all human societies face about the same problems. They solve them in an interesting variety of different ways, and they're all grown-ups. So you should take all of them seriously. There is no good reason to believe that we're smarter than the people responsible for the legal system of Periclean Athens. That was a very famous society. Of Imperial China, that was a legal system that lasted with occasional intermissions for about 2,000 years. Or any of these other people that I'm studying. Their systems might be better, it might be worse, but it's worth taking seriously, seeing how it worked, trying to understand it, and so forth. That's the basic inspiration of the course. And I found it interesting because it's a way of learning more about the law, of seeing legal issues through a different angle, of getting ideas we might want to borrow for our legal, for our law. I will be explaining at some point in this course why I believe that our legal system is a mere 1,000 years behind the cutting edge of legal technology, due to at least one idea we might want to steal. It's also fun. Mechanics of the course. I taught it every other year at Santa Clara for quite a long time. And eventually I produced a book. This is the print copy of the book. It's also available as a very inexpensive Kindle. Kindles let you make your books available cheaply. But if you want to read it for free, that's the URL. I think it was sent out to you. I don't know if they sent you that URL or a different one. There's a slightly earlier draft elsewhere on my webpage, and I don't remember which one I gave them, but that's at least the more almost current, almost published version of the book that can be read for free online. You may find it worth reading it. I'm planning to go through more or less in order, so as long as you sort of stay a few chapters ahead, you'll be fine. There are two kinds of chapters in the book. What I refer to as systems chapters, which describe some legal system, tries to understand how it worked. And what I think of as thread chapters, which discuss an issue that runs through multiple systems. So for example, one of the issues through multiple systems is if God is the legislator. If your legal system is not passed by a legislature, but is fixed, sort of nailed to the wall because it's divine inspiration, how do you then deal with situations where God got it wrong? And that's sort of the problem for Islamic law, for Jewish law, but I argue also for American constitutional law. Because although the Constitution, we don't quite say the founders were gods, nonetheless, like the religious system, you've got the problem of a fixed set of rules that are very hard to change. And we deal with it the same way they did, which is to interpret around it. I like to say that by the standards of the rabbis, every Supreme Court justice in history was a strict constructionist. And you will see more of that when we get to Jewish law, which is quite a lot of fun. But there are lots of other threads you'll see. I'll be following the order of topics in the book. I'm omitting the two chapters that were written by other people, but they're fun chapters. You may want to read them. One of them is about 18th century pirates, and one of them is about criminal gangs in prisons, in particular in California prisons. David Scarbeck doesn't quite say that he thinks that the California prison gangs are a good thing, but he obviously does. And he provides some evidence that they have made things better and not worse in the gangs. So those are fun chapters, but I figured I had to cut something. And I'm cutting it, I think, one or two other chapters. But I'm doing most of it, and we may or may not make it to the end. That's partly going to depend on how much you people want to talk and how many interesting conversations we have and so forth. But anything I leave out, you can always read the book. All right. When I taught it as a seminar at SCU, each student wrote a paper on a legal system, one that I wasn't covering, and about half the course was discussing the papers. Many of the papers are currently webbed on my website. If people ask me, I can probably set things up on the website to make an easy way for you to find them. At the moment, they're sort of scattered among the web pages for various courses I taught. I assume most of you will not want to write papers. However, if anybody does, feel free to pick some legal system that is not covered in the book and that is not close to ours. From my standpoint, modern German law, French law, Japanese law are all just variants of our legal system are much less interesting. The closest thing I come is the 18th century English stuff. Ideally, pick one you have some connection to, where you know the language or you're interested in the society or its history. My favorite story on that, back when I was teaching it here, was that I had a student who was a fairly tall, sort of European-looking fellow. And when I said, you know, do any of you know anything in particular that would help you on a legal system, he said, well, I do know Vietnamese. And I was a little surprised at that. And I said, well, how do you know Vietnamese? And he said, well, I'm a Mormon. I was a missionary. And I said, in Vietnam? And he said, no, Los Angeles. Mormons are not stupid. That's a very clever idea if you think about it. Anyway, so he did me a paper on the legal system of historical Vietnam, of ancient Vietnam. So if anybody does feel like doing it, I can web your paper. We can talk about it in class and so forth. But it's not an obligation, obviously, for this course. All right, some things to think about as we go, some of the sort of thread topics that you can pick out as we go in different legal systems. One of them I mentioned, when God is the legislator, how does a legal system deal with the fact that its authority is, in effect, a pre-existing text? Embedded and polylegal systems that we will be discussing, in fact, today even, a couple of legal systems which exist where we are. They exist in the modern day America and are not American law or California law, and nonetheless manage to enforce their own rules on their own people. Those are what I think of as embedded legal systems. One which we'll be discussing, but not today, for 1,500 years more or less, most Jews were living under Jewish law despite the fact that there was no Jewish state. The Kingdom of Israel had been destroyed by the Romans. However, most of the Christian and Jewish rulers found the easiest way of dealing with their Jewish subjects was to subcontract the job of ruling them to the Jewish communal authorities. That's in a different kind of embedded system. Polylegal systems, systems where in the same place there is more than one legal system functioning. So in a traditional Sunni Islamic society, there were four different schools of law. They were all mutually orthodox, and you might have courts for all four of them in the same city. So that's an interesting set of issues. And in fact, if you think about it long enough, you realize that the modern American system is polylegal too, but we may get to that later. Enforcement mechanisms. How do you enforce the law? We are used to thinking of law enforcement in terms of cops, but in fact, the US, most modern systems combine a privately enforced and a publicly enforced system. That is to say, tort law, civil law in general, when somebody wrongs you, you don't call a cop, you call a lawyer. And if in fact, if you look at a wider range of societies as we will be, you not only have systems in which criminal law was privately prosecuted, you have systems in which the verdict was privately enforced. So that's an interesting set of issues of different things in which you have different mechanisms for enforcing legal rules. The problem of error. How do we avoid convicting innocent people, and how do you deal with it when we do? And that's a very interesting and very important problem. And there's an obvious solution and then possibly less obvious solutions. The obvious solution is that you either reduce the errors by not trying as hard to convict people, which has the disadvantage that some guilty people get away, or by having higher standards of proof, which again results in more guilty people getting away. And the interesting puzzle is, can you think up mechanisms where the people who are making the decisions that end up convicting somebody actually have a selfish interest only to get the guilty people and not the innocent ones? And that's a harder problem than one might think, but I'm going to argue that I can think of at least one example where that's true, and there may be others. Guarding the guardians. How do we prevent the people who are supposed to be enforcing the law from themselves violating the law? And this is a live issue in modern day America. We worry about police shootings. We worry about the National Security Agency illegally spying on the rest of us. We worry about a lot of things of that general sort. And it's an old problem. Guarding the guardians is coming from a Latin phrase, quo custodes ipsos custodiat, who will guard the guardians? And it comes from an entirely non-political context. If you read my footnotes, you will discover that the origin of that phrase has nothing to do with the way we normally use it, but it's nonetheless interesting. And finally, think about applications of the stuff we're doing to our legal system. Are there cases where what we're observing in another legal system parallels things in our legal system? Are there cases where we might get warnings for how things might go wrong if we do things in a certain way? And are there ideas we'd like to borrow? All right, so those are all things to sort of keep in the back of your mind as we're going. Let me now go on to the first legal system that I cover, and that's Imperial China. The system was established about 200 BC. The first empire was a little bit earlier than that, and the first empire followed apparently a legal philosophy called legalism, and it crashed and burned with the death of the first emperor. And it was then succeeded by the Han Dynasty, which claimed to be Confucian. There had been this sort of running dispute between the Confucians and the legalists, but if you look at what they actually did, it was really a blend of the two systems. And Imperial Chinese law, from our standpoint, has a bunch of odd features. One of them was that it was, at least on paper, a pure criminal system. I was mentioning before the possibility of a pure tort or pure civil system. And Imperial China was a system where, in principle, there was no way of suing anybody. All you could do was charge people with crimes, essentially. And I'll discuss that in more detail in a minute. It had a legal system where the law code was designed to be a complete mapping of offense to punishment, in which, in principle, you were supposed to be able to say, he did this, this is exactly the punishment he gets. Again, it didn't work, but it was an interesting effort. I sometimes describe it as the mission of the US Sentencing Commission in large, that is to try to figure out what sentences should be. One of the things that I find intriguing about it is that we think of one feature of an oppressive society is that they try to make children inform against their parents. In Imperial China, accusing your parent of an offense of which your parent was guilty was a criminal offense by you. It was illegal to report your parents to the cops. And it'll be an interesting question why, and I think I know why. All right. The system was run by a bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy was staffed by the original civil service exam system. They're the people who invented it. The first level of the exam, about a quarter of 1% of the population had passed it. The second level, about 1% of the people. You had to pass the first one in order to get to the second. Second, about 1%, and the third, about 1-2% passed. And the part of the puzzle is that this horrendously difficult exam was not testing your this was the exam which ultimately produced the civil servants, produced the bureaucracy. It was not testing your knowledge of administration. It was not testing your knowledge of the law. It was testing things like how good your calligraphy was, how well you had memorized the classical Confucian texts, how good you were at writing a particular form of essay or at improvising poetry. Nothing relevant to the job being tested for. Right. So that's one of the puzzles. Right. So let me discuss the sense in which it was or wasn't a pure criminal system. I lend you money and you don't pay it back. There is no mechanism by which I can go to the court and say, make him pay me money. All I can do is to go to the district magistrate and charge you with being a swindler. At this point, the case is in his hands, and in principle, he could refuse to take the case. He could say you would be punished according to the law and go away. I don't care about you, the guy who the money is owed to. Or he could say, pay him the money and I'll let you go. That's up to him. But what actually happens at this point is that with regard to minor matters, let me go back a step. When I first tried to understand this system, I was reading a good secondary source written maybe 40 or 50 years ago. And that source was based on the description of the legal system by the Confucian elite, by the people running it. After China opened up, people got access to low-level court documents. And they could actually see how the system worked rather than how it was supposed to work. And with regard to minor matters, which consist of debt, property, marriage, and inheritance, it's still on paper a criminal system, but what's actually happening is the magistrate is a very busy man. So I charge you with being a swindler. The magistrate says, come back in a couple of weeks, we can try this case. I then go to you and say, do you really want to be exiled 1,000 miles from home for 3 years, or whatever the penalty in the statutes is for what you've done? I don't remember what the penalty is for that one. And you say, no, I don't. And I say, well, look, how about you pay me half the money now and then make monthly payments? You say, yeah, I agree to do that. We go back to the magistrate. Magistrate could ignore us if we want, but he's got a lot of other things to do. So when we humbly request that the magistrate drop the case, he drops the case. So what you really had in that system was civil law in the form of criminal law with regard to these minor matters. That you have bargaining done in the shadow of the fact that I can get you if the case goes. So that was one of the intriguing things, discovering the difference between the picture seen from above and the picture seen from below. The legal system, as I said, was supposed to specify for every case an exact punishment. That was the theory. But you can't do that if you think about how much different offenses can vary. And there were a couple of ways in which they solved that. First one was they interpolated. They said, all right, this offense is pretty much like that offense which the law says results in your being exiled for 3 years, but it's not quite as serious, so we'll exile you for 2 years. Things of that sort. I should say, the official system was very elaborate because there were lots of things that modified what it was. Such as whether you had committed an offense against a junior relative, in which case you don't get punished as much, or against a senior relative, in which case you get punished more. I'll get to that stuff in a minute. If they couldn't find any statute you had violated, well, they could convict you of doing what ought not to be done. They could also convict you, a different part of the law, of violating an imperial edict, even though the edict wasn't there. And the idea was that you ought to know how good people behaved. if this matter had been brought to the attention of the emperor, he would have made an edict, and therefore you had violated an imperial edict. So it was a system which, on the one hand, they had this very elaborate and to some extent followed out system for determining the punishment, but then they had ways of dealing with the fact that it didn't really work, and I'll come to some other ways in which, in a minute, in which it didn't really work. Because the punishments stated in the law weren't always exactly what they appeared to be. In particular, there were a bunch of nominally capital punishments which didn't actually result in your being executed. That the two of these were decapitation after the assizes and strangulation after the assizes. I should say, decapitation before the assizes really meant they cut your head off. Ditto for strangulation. Decapitation is worse than strangulation because your body is no longer together, and that causes you problems in the afterlife, apparently. And the third really capital punishment was death by slicing, the famous death of a thousand cuts, which was basically being tortured to death. But those were very unusual. But the main capital ones were capital after the assizes. And at the assizes, you were then put in jail for a while. And then once a year, yeah?
What are assizes?
They were basically a court procedure involving the emperor. And at that procedure, the bureaucrats sorted the cases. And most of them were people deserving compassion or a son who has to stay at home to take care of his aged parents, or various categories of those sorts. And those ones automatically got changed. In the extreme case where the son had to stay at home to take care of his aged parents, they had him wear the kang, which is a sort of a wooden board. I've got a picture of it in my book that makes it hard for you to feed yourself, for example. It was sort of a shaming punishment with things written on it. For a certain length of time, and then he stayed at home for a certain length of time, but they didn't actually do anything very serious to him. Most of the others, it got converted to something like 2 or 3 years of exile. Then the minority that they thought were really serious, there was apparently a ceremony where they write the names on a big sheet of paper, and the emperor draws a circle, and according to who you believe, either the people in the circle or the people out of the circle, we aren't sure which, get again shifted down to a non-capital one. The ones who aren't released by this are put back in jail, and they do the process again another year and then another year. And if you make it through 3 years, then they don't execute you. So it was a complicated system, and the calculations suggest that the numbers actually executed were pretty small. We're talking about, by the end of the empire, about a population of about 400 million people. This is not a small society. And I think the numbers suggest that maybe a few hundred people a year were being executed, actually. So that was one part of it. 50 blows of the light bamboo actually meant 20 blows. At some point or other, they introduced a modification, and one theory is that they were using heavier light bamboos than they used to, and they didn't want to kill people, but we don't really know. But there were a bunch of similar transformations in which you have a nominal thing. And of course, we have some of that too. If you think about, you get a 10-year sentence, but you may get let off for good behavior. Finally, the court could, but didn't have to, permit monetary redemption. The court could say, you were sentenced to 100 blows of the light bamboo, but we'll let you off for 5 ounces of silver or something. And if you look at these redemptions, they're pretty small. That they really look like almost nominal punishments. And it's not entirely clear what determines it, because the court doesn't have to. All right? So the question then is, why do they have all of these elaborate things? One answer is because the rigid system gives the wrong answer. All right? If you say, look, a court, I've looked it up in the law book, we're supposed to execute that guy, but look, you wouldn't want to execute him. Look what he really did. Yes, he killed somebody, but he killed somebody who was trying to kill his father. He killed someone who was trying to rape his niece. Those are cases where he's committed a crime. So that's one possible answer. Another possible answer, and this gets to a point I'm going to be discussing, which is figuring out how much of this stuff is driven by religion and culture and how much by function, as it were, is the idea that if you would kill, that a life for a life, that you had to have cosmic balance. So if you had killed somebody, that meant that someone had to die for it. But maybe you can fool the gods by having somebody just nominally die. That is, be be sentenced to an execution they don't have. And one of the odd and interesting bits which does suggest this is that if you have a case where several people have been responsible for a murder, and one of them is condemned to be executed, and one of the others dies in prison before the execution, then the guy doesn't have to be executed. There's been a life for a life, even if it was not the one you sentenced. So that's a possible explanation of what's going on. And a third possibility is that if you assume the potential criminals aren't aware of all of the ways of getting out of it, then you say, by having a nominally very severe punishment, we can scare people out of committing crimes. Do you know that you would get your head cut off if you did that? And we don't have to actually do it, and that way we can save these people to be imperial slaves or taxpayers or whatever the empire wants them to be due if it doesn't execute them. So those are all possibilities. But I don't know the answer. Many of these I don't know the answers. I'm just trying to guess at it. So this gets into the point I was just making in explaining these legal systems. Do you say, what purpose did this rule serve? Or do you say the reason this rule was there was some special feature of their culture? I prefer to do the former, because if I can find functional explanations, those are going to apply across all legal systems, or at least many legal systems. Whereas if it's special to the culture, well, tough luck. We're not looking at China in the next chapter. But you can't always do it. And there are features of the Chinese legal system which I try to think up plausible explanations, and maybe they're right, but I may be wrong. For example, you are a district magistrate. That means that you are the combination mayor, judge, and chief of police for a population in the hundreds of thousands. All right, very important official. If your father or mother dies, you are no longer a district magistrate for the next 27 months, that being the period of required mourning for a parent. All right, that seems sort of crazy. I mean, you really want to say, all right, the mayor's father died, he's out for the next couple of years. And yet they did that. Now, maybe there was a reason. Some of my conjectures about features of this system was they were trying to make sure that the officials didn't get too much power. So, for example, you could not be the district magistrate of a district that included your own village that you'd grown up in. You could not own property where you were a district magistrate, and you could not marry somebody in the district you were district magistrate of. And all of that looks a little bit as though they're trying to keep the system from turning into feudalism, to keep the officials from becoming, in effect, local lords. Because, of course, dynasties end. You have these periods when the dynasty is breaking down, the system's collapsing, and then eventually a new dynasty arises. So some of that may be going on, and that's sort of one of, but this still seems pretty extreme. Punishment in the legal code depends on the outcome and not a motivation. And the particular case that struck me here was killing two or more members of the same family was a very serious offense. And there was a case where the reason he killed two or more members of the same family was that that group of people had attacked him and his household, and the second guy he killed had just killed his father. Nonetheless, he is sentenced. I'm not sure if he's executed, but he is not given monetary redemption. Seems crazy to us. And there's another case in the list of. When I taught the course, I had a book which had a whole bunch of actual cases, and I had the students read through those. And there's a case where I think a district magistrate, some fairly high official, is being carried in his palanquin, a human-carried sort of vehicle, and he is supposed to stop and do some things and get off when he gets to the entrance of the temple. And it's raining very hard, and his bearers carry him right through the entrance. He gets punished for that, severely punished. He loses his position and has some further punishment. So again, it looks like a rather rigid system in which it's defined by results, except there are all these outs by which if the court doesn't like the result, they can modify it. You could not execute somebody through about half the year. Various times of the year, for different reasons, executions were forbidden. You just have to, I should say, you don't have imprisonment as an official punishment. You don't even have fines as an official punishment in this system, except to the extent that you're compensating somebody, paying the cost of the funeral of someone you've killed, for example. But you do have long time periods in imprisonment while you're waiting for the wheels to grind, and you do have, as I say, monetary substitutes for other punishments sometimes. And again, part of this might be the fear that if you disturb the cosmic balance, if you have executions when it's unlucky to have executions, there will be a flood or a tornado or something. But again, we don't really know. Yes?
So can I ask a question?
Sure.
It just seemed that on the previous slide there would seem to be, I can see a sort of a functional reason for each of these.
Yes, good.
Like one, just as you said, you've got an official, you don't want any officials getting too strong a grasp on power. So if there's periodic random breaks in their power, that disrupts their ability to consolidate.
That's a possibility.
And that way that you keep getting these groups that just get all the power.
But they also move them around. I think it's a three-year term.
So again, things that make it difficult to acquire too much
might
power.
Be.
Right, and in the to kill two members of that family, now to make it difficult to wipe out a family, you could just say basically, oh, these guys are...
Their families are extended families.
Right, right.
They're talking about a lot of people.
A herd of family. You take them two at a time, three, four, you know. And in other words, these guys, you claim that these guys did something to you, but you know, you're just basically...
Yeah, but the court, one of the interesting things, if you look at the cases that we've got, at least we had, at least in the book I was originally reading, are all the equivalent of appeals court cases. They're all high-level cases. And they aren't arguing whether the guy is guilty or not. They're only arguing about what the proper punishment is.
So what I'm saying is the underlying cause of these might be functional in the sense of let's not have one
family. It's not the two or more that I'm puzzled by. It's the fact that a two or more with what looks like an enormously good excuse is still treated as a very serious offense. Next interesting feature. I mentioned that they invented the civil service exam. If you pass the first level of the exam, you are what is called a licentiate. And that's a sort of a slightly upper class kind of thing. It gives you a certain amount of status, some legal advantages. And it gives you permission to take the second level, which has a pass rate of about 1%, as I was saying. We believe that about 0.25% of the population, so at the peak population, which was about 400 million, there would be about 1 million licentiates. The licentiates could take an exam, and each time they if all million chose to take it in 1 year, about 10,000 of them would have actually made it to the next level, at which point that really qualifies you for getting an appointment somewhere in the bureaucracy. And you could then take the third level, which has, again, almost as low a pass rate, at which by the time you do that, you're probably in your 30s. People could take these exams over and over. I think they're given every year, I think, or maybe every 2 years. But at that point, you're going to get a high-level job. And I should say, one of the interesting things, going back to the question of controlling the system, the censorate was not censors in our sense. The censorate was the bureaucracy in charge of watching the rest of the bureaucracy. So a censor would go around seeing if the district magistrate was corrupt. If you did very, very well on the third level exam, you became a district magistrate. If you did even better, you became a censor. Yes.
I assume these are all men.
Yes. Yes. I don't think. Yeah. I think that's correct. I can't think of any roles in the bureaucracy being filled by women in that system. But then, as I say, what the exam was testing was the ability to write a particular kind of essay. There was a certain style of essay, to compose poetry, to have beautiful calligraphy, to know Confucian literature, the classics, very, very, very well. All things would seem irrelevant to the job. So that's part of the puzzle of this system. And this is a system where if you're a village and there's a kid in the village who's obviously very, very bright, the rest of the villagers have an incentive to try to feed him and take care of him and let him spend all of his time studying these things in order that there will be somebody in the bureaucracy from their village suddenly jump from a low status to a high status position and so forth. So, yes?
Is it assumed that they knew the criteria?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. This was all public. You studied for 20 years to pass this exam. The essay is a particular kind of essay. They called it the four-legged essay. I don't know why, but it's a particular structure of essay you were supposed to write. So that's an interesting puzzle. And let's think of some possible explanations again. One of them is it was a very fancy IQ test. All right, the ability to do all these things shows you're very smart. We want very smart people as our bureaucrats. It seems hard to believe that you couldn't make a cheaper, fancy IQ test, but nonetheless, that's one interpretation. A second and more interesting one is that it's a way of indoctrinating the bureaucracy with Confucian values. If I go back to the Confucian versus legalist view of the law, which is sort of an interesting subject, the legalists had what I would think of as a modern view of the law, that you get people to obey the law by punishing them if you don't. They also had a rather egalitarian view that it should be the same punishment for everybody, independent of your status, your relationship, and so forth and so on. The Confucians, in principle, didn't really believe in punishing people, although once they were in power, they did. But in principle, the emperor set such a good example of noble and virtuous behavior that everybody imitated him. And that was sort of the ideal of that system. So if you think about it in terms of your bureaucracy, what do you want of your district magistrate? It would be nice if he knew how to do a good job, but maybe you can have subordinates who are trained in that who aren't bureaucrats. The other is wanting to do a good job, all right? He is going to be the mother, father, official caring for the people under him. Well, maybe you want to go to a whole lot of trouble to make him learn that view of the world in which that's his job, and which is also his job to obey the people over him. So that's, I think, a somewhat more interesting and perhaps more plausible. And another variant of that is think about those million people, most of whom did not pass the second level. They've all spent a lot of time studying Confucian classics, so maybe it's a way of getting sort of the whole upper stratum indoctrinated in a particular viewpoint. That, it seems to me, I don't know if it's right, but those seem to me plausible. On the other hand, it isn't quite so weird a system because we've got it too. If you think about it for a while, what do you have to do in order to get a high-status job in the U.S.? You have to graduate from college. What does your college course consist of? Well, you're going to be an engineer, so of course you have to study Elizabethan poetry and Shakespeare and sociology and a whole bunch of other things that have nothing to do with the job you're going to be doing. All right? So in fact, one can think about why we do it that way, and are we trying to, what we call a liberal education? Maybe that's an attempt to indoctrinate our elite, as it were, with some set of values and views and common cultural things. Maybe it's just crazy. It's not clear to me it's the right way of doing things. But nonetheless, I find it intriguing that after we've looked at this weird society that's got this crazy system, to realize that we have quite a lot of that crazy system at home. And as you may know, there is some literature of people trying to figure out why we do it. There's evidence that quite a large fraction of people who go to college and know more when they graduate than when they enter. Nonetheless, they make more money. Why? And that's an interesting puzzle. All right. Another feature of the Chinese system, they were ruling a large population with a small bureaucracy. Right. How do you do it? And there are a number of tricks to make it work. One of them is to subcontract as much of the job as you can. And the largest, there were several other authority structures, but the main one was probably the extended family. And in the family system, all relatives classify as either senior or junior. And the first cut is the tree. So even if I am older than my uncle, because you're talking about a large extended family, my uncle is still senior to me because he's ahead of me on the tree. On the other hand, between brothers, between people at the same level on the tree, the older one is senior. Any offense committed against a senior relative, the punishment is pushed up. Any offense committed against a junior relative, the punishment is pushed down. You are expected to obey a senior relative. The fact that a senior relative told you to commit a crime doesn't mean that you don't get punished for the crime, but you would get punished for not obeying him. And as I mentioned, it's illegal to accuse your parent of a crime. And I think the reason is that they want to reinforce the internal authority structure within the extended family. After all, big society, quite likely my parent has committed some crime. If I've got the weapon against him, you know, if you try to make me do that job you want me to do, I'll whisper to the authorities about you, that's going to undermine his power. So as I interpret, at least, they were willing to give up some ability to enforce the law in order to maintain the authority structure within the extended family so that then most of the business of making people behave could be done within the extended family rather than within the court system. That's my reading of what was going on, and I think it's sort of an intriguing thing. And again, you can say it's just cultural, they believed in whatever families, et cetera, but I think it's got a functional, plausible functional explanation. Another way you cut down the job is to give people reasons not to go to law. witnesses could be tortured. Make sure they say the right thing. The defendant was expected to be very humble, to kneel. He could be tortured too. In general, if you look at the descriptions of the court processes, the magistrate and his people are up there, and everybody else is down here. So that means that people are going to try to settle their disputes somewhere other than the courts, reduces the work that has to be done by the official system. Now, that one problem with that that might occur to you is, suppose I want to get you. I can accuse you of a crime, and now even if you're innocent, sure, you'll after a year and a half, they'll let you go and stop torturing you and let you out of the prison because they've decided you're innocent, but that gets you. Ah, but if I accuse you of a crime, then I'm a witness. I'm enmeshed in the system. So you say the solution to that is obvious to any modern person. You send an anonymous accusation. It was illegal for the magistrate to read an anonymous accusation. First time that rule went in, there was an exception for accusations of treason against the empire, and the next emperor removed the exception. Not stupid people, all right? All right. Yes?
If you were in the first thing, subcontractor extended family.
Yeah, right.
That's how you would rule a large family. But what's it got to do with ruling a large population?
Because it means that the reason the kid doesn't do X, Y, and Z that are bad things doesn't require you to actually get him to the magistrate. It just requires for his father or his uncle to notice and beat him. So that the family doesn't want to get the family in trouble, so they want to make sure their members all behave well, and they can enforce it without you ever going through the...
So it's not the extended family of the magistrate?
No, no, it's the extended family. Everybody is an extended family. In principle, if you have the same name as somebody, you're a member of his family, although they can't usually trace it if the separation was 17 generations up. But that's correct. So another possible way you do it is that you use norms and indoctrination to control by making people willing to do it. And if you think about that, that really goes back to the Confucian legalist split, even though they were never willing to go all the way, that they both indoctrinated their magistrates and had the censors going around keeping an eye on them, and similarly for everybody else. All right? So that's Chinese. Yes?
Don't know.
I have not studied the current Chinese. I am sure that there are effects from this. I know a little bit about the legal system under the Republic, which was what immediately followed the empire, because I did read a book on that, and there was some interesting stuff about the way it did and didn't change. And the particular example that they discussed is the Republic initially carried over the pre-existing legal system, but they had a different view of it. And the particular case is discussed is a situation where somebody dies without an heir. And there are rules where basically the heir has to meet certain requirements. It's supposed to be basically a relative of the same generation as a son would have been. And then there somehow the widow and the kin agree on which person it's going to be. And if you have a case under the Republic where somebody is appointed who is, I think by the widow, who does not meet the requirements, and someone else sues to stop him, and the first level court says, that's right, we'll have to stop it. But when it gets to the Supreme Court, they say, what is your claim, the person who's suing? That after all, you aren't somebody who meets the requirements. You don't have a son who meets the requirements, so you haven't been wronged by this act. Since you haven't been wronged, you have no standing, and therefore we let the system stay. Whereas it's clear that under the imperial system, the magistrate would have said, who cares whether you've got standing? This is an unjust act. I'm going to fix it. So it was a change in perspective between thinking of it as a system where the ultimate authority is at the top and thinking of it as something more like a modern legal system of rights. All right. So that was, yes?
And the Republic was just before...
The Republic... ends up with a civil war, which the communists win, except for Taiwan, where the nationalists are still holding out, right? But I have not investigated. In general, I've mostly tried to avoid modern systems, except for people like the Romani and the Amish, who are still around, but who have their own system, because I'm trying to look for things very different. And if I had to guess, it's that the communist one probably has elements of other modern legal systems, maybe some elements of, but I'm sure the culture is still there. That is, I would not be surprised if one did study modern communist China, it would help to have studied imperial China, but I haven't done it. Yes?
One other question about these systems that embed a lot of flexibility.
Yes.
Is that you have this sort of jurisdictional variation, right? Where, you know, one magistrate might be a strict constructionist and the next magistrate might be a much...
There's an appeal system. Any serious verdict by the magistrate has to be sent up to the next level to be approved. And sufficiently serious, in theory, goes all the way to the emperor. I think capital offenses all have to be decided by the emperor, although one suspects that most emperors had assistants who did a good deal of the work. Now, when the system was breaking down, which as they did periodically, that might well happen. But I think, as far as I can tell, they've got written law codes in great detail. Now, I guess whether you allowed people to compound with money, that's interesting. I don't know whether that gets appealed or not. So that might be a way in which, mostly what court it ends up in is not determined by the parties, right? It's where it happened. And it's a criminal system, so they're being charged. They're not, I mean, you can report and try to get somebody charged, but. All right, well, I was gonna make the second half of this on Romani and Amish. So let's first see if there are any more questions or comments about the Chinese, and then we can all take our break. Anybody? Yes.
I just noticed that it seemed that the Chinese, all of the laws, the Chinese seem to be under the idea that harmony was very important.
Yep.
In other words, as long as you have harmony without internal conflicts, a rigid hierarchical structure of rights, right? Those above have more rights than those below. Those below can't question those above.
Yeah.
So they're going after trying to hit a sweet spot. That sweet spot between efficiency and quality, I think you might call it. You know, which is, you get efficiency, things that's harmony. Mm. Quality, I think, comes from maybe being a little more flexible and allowing somebody with an outside the box type thinking find a fresh new idea.
Yeah, one of the things that tends to happen, Imperial China wasn't very good at winning wars. And part of the reason, I think, is that if you had a really good general, he was dangerous. A point which other societies have observed before. And so you wanted to be a little careful about using him. Other things, there are a bunch of other interesting stuff. I mean, when you read the chapter, you'll see that I'm only giving you a sketch of it. Causing someone to commit suicide was a capital offense. So one way of getting vengeance, if you were desperate enough, was to kill yourself in ways which. We had a case not that long ago in the U.S. where somebody killed himself, and the people who it was claimed at least were responsible for it. It was never really clear whether what they had done was the reason, but it might have been. Got a huge amount of criticism. The president said that they should be punished, and they ended up getting punished. Both of them ended up getting punished, and so it's lots of things that are a little less strange once you look at them. It was in some ways a legally pretty egalitarian system in the sense that there were a fairly small number of people who were in a very low class, who were sort of slaves or descendants of slaves, then a massive population. In the last dynasty was the Manchu dynasty, which had been established by a conquest by the Manchus, who were nomads just north of China. And there you ended up with the Manchus and a group of Chinese and Mongols who had helped the Manchus having a special status, the so-called banners, which were theoretically military units. But mostly it was unequal, not so much in terms of your status in the society as your relation to other people. So that killing a parent was a hugely serious offense. Killing your own child, well, if you had no excuse, you would get punished for it. But if the child had, had reviled your parents, for example, had done anything that was sufficiently serious, you could probably get away with killing him. Anyway, I go into more detail on that in the book because it's complicated.
So the Chinese were much less litigious than we are, for example, probably because...
Well, that depends who you believe, because there is some stuff from the stuff that came out late when they got access to the courts where you've got people in the Chinese system complaining about a particular province where they're always trying to go to the courts and what a nuisance it is and such. And they haven't have a book telling them how to file complaints and such.
In this period that we're talking about?
This would be in the last dynasty. Yeah. Remember, when we say this period, we're talking about 2,000 years.
Yeah, yeah,
but
okay.
Our best information is, of course, the most recent dynasty. That's the Manchu. And they were about the last 200 or 300 years. Yeah?
Did the Manchus have the same respect for the teachings of Confucius that the other earlier?
Yeah, I think all of the conquerors, in some sense, became Chinese.
Uh-huh.
And so you still have the theoretical adherence to Confucian values, I think, through all of those. All right, we're just about in the middle. Why don't we take our 10-minute break now? And then I can tell you about the Romani and the Amish.
By the way, we have some...